Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Evan Botcher, and he'll be answering your questions on the West Branch of the Au Sable River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Evan a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you have to leave early, you can return to the website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Evan Botcher about the West Branch of the Au Sable River. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves in creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you like to dye your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Evan, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For the drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Evan's section that says register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a dozen of Evan's best flies for the Au Sable River, courtesy of the Hungry Trout Fly Shop. So if you want to win the dozen flies, here's how you can win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be something that Evan and I talk about during the show. So submit your answer along with your name, location, using the text box on our homepage. And the first one that gets it right will win those dozen flies from the Hungry Trout Fly Shop on the Au Sable River. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, take notes, and maybe you'll be the proud owner of those dozen flies. Our guest tonight is Evan Botcher. Evan was raised at the Hungry Trout and learned to fly fish on the Au Sable River when he was 10 years old. Evan honed his skills in southwest Colorado, fishing the Animas River and surrounding Rocky Mountain streams. Fly fishing has brought him many places, having cast a fly in Belize, Labrador, Bahamas, Argentina, Alaska, and most western states. He would return each May to guide a roster of return clients, which he prefers to exhaust in full-day excursions to remote sections of the river. Evan and his wife, Caitlin, are now in their 10th year owning the Hungry Trout Fly Shop and ready for 99 more. Evan, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. And lots to learn tonight about the Au Sable River. And we're talking about the West Branch of the Au Sable River. And let's get squared away where this is, because there's some confusion, because there's another Au Sable River in Michigan,
yeah.
Right? And
exactly.
I'm sure you get that confusion quite a bit. So let's start out on telling us where it is. Yeah, you know, and we do have an international audience, so it's always good to pinpoint what we're talking about.
Excellent. Yeah, so the West Branch of the Au Sable River, not to be confused with the Au Sable in Michigan, the Au Sable River is located it comes right out of the center of the high peaks of the Adirondack Mountains. The Adirondacks are in northern New York, about 2 hours north of Albany. about 5 hours north of New York City. So we're tucked right up in the northeast corner of New York. And the Aufsable River originates in the high peaks of the Adirondacks, which is a really scenic and mountainous region of New York. And the West Branch, specifically the West Branch, flows about 30, 35 miles until it meets the main stem. And the main stem continues on into Lake Champlain, which is the border between New York and Vermont.
Right, right. So what makes the West Branch of the Aufsable River such a unique fly fishing destination?
A lot of things. You'll get a different answer from many people because it's a unique region in the fact that it has a robust history, both in fly fishing as well as just historical events from the founding of the nation, back from the Revolutionary War and War of 1812. A lot of the battles of the founding of the nation were taking place right at the headwaters of the Aufsable. Or I'm sorry, at the end of the Aufsable where it runs into Lake Champlain. So there's a major historical element to the river that you don't find in many other regions, right? So that deep history really is what got the fly fishing scene started on the East Coast. The Catskills was kind of the home of fly fishing, and the Adirondacks was like the destination for a lot of those old classic fly tiers and the grandfathers of the sport that were kind of starting the first publications and documenting fly fishing also took place up here. So there's a lot of history, both in the history of fly fishing as well as just American history, that is represented in the corridor here that makes it just very unique, and you can kind of feel that kind of history and that age in the character of the region, you know. So it's really unique in those elements. And I'd add a third one for the East Coast, specifically New York and the whole Appalachian connection, which we're not part of the Appalachians, but mind you, we're our own mountainous region. But you really don't find the vertical relief or the dramatic geography that you have many other places on the East Coast. The Adirondacks are rugged, tall, and very ancient mountains. So it's very unique in the New England fishing scene to have 30 miles of deep pocket water, right? So the structure that you have when you fish the river is also super unique. It's incredibly fun, pocket water, and a little bit more rougher water for me. It's what I grew up fishing and living in Colorado, a lot of steep rivers there too. So the Aufsable is very unique in the region, and there's not many rivers in the East Coast that provide that sort of landscape, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Now, is there an East Branch then?
A middle branch?
So, or how is that configured?
Exactly. Yep, so there's a West Branch and an East Branch. Each of them are almost equal in length. They're about 30 miles, and they meet at the confluence of the main, obviously, which is another 30 miles. So the whole watershed, let's say, is, you know, 90 to 100 miles. When you combine them all. The West Branch, it's funny because no matter where you are, you hear different things. Like two biologists working for the same government agency will tell you different things, you know. So, but the one biologist who has since retired but who was in charge of our region growing up, he had always mentioned that the West Branch comes out of a much slower, feeding, boggy, kind of swampy watershed, and then it spills into the West Branch. The East Branch comes out of a lot of slab and granite, and there's not that, like, rich, boggy, soil-rich meadow structure before it plunges into the river, right? So because of which, the East Branch has a lot quicker and a lot quicker flush of water and nutrients, et cetera, where the West Branch has a much more controlled and kind of slower release from the headwaters. So the West Branch, because of which it has just a little healthier and more sustaining bug population, trout population, and just like you can just tell by being in the two rivers that it's a little bit more rich environment in the stream. So the East Branch just doesn't have the ecological structure, for lack of a better word, that the West Branch has. So it used to be a much better fishery, and it has a lot of tributaries, but the East is not revered.
Okay.
As much as the West is, not really, not even close.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it sounds like more bug life in the West Branch, that kind of thing, because of the slower moving water compared to the East and the lack of flushing that you talked about. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah,
yeah.
it's just a lot more structure, a lot more habitat, and just better hatching. So couple those things together, and it really stands out.
Yeah. Has the reputation of the river changed over the years? I mean, and you know, I mean, if you know some of the old fly fishers from years past, I don't mean personally, but those that have fished,
yeah.
and we would know by name because of the old books and stuff. Has it changed? Has it morphed, so to speak, into the modern day as far as its reputation?
I believe so. All of the rivers that I have experience with they're in a time period of change, right? And I think you're seeing that everywhere. We were just in Argentina in April. We go down there fairly often, bring in some groups down, and they're dealing with the same thing as far as prolonged summers and lack of water, and the environment is becoming more challenging. And that has an effect on cold water fisheries, without a question. So what happens when you have people fishing it for decades, it's very clear that there's, in all of our cold water fisheries, that there's challenges that we didn't deal with before. And our river's no exception. So I wouldn't say the reputation, it has changed, but because there's so many new people coming to the sport, because the river itself is very unique, I think the reputation of the river is always going to be known as a, you know, we're using the word unique out there. Fill me in with a better word.
Yeah,
there's just not many rivers like it. So the big draw from people who live in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts, Vermont, you know, they come over here down from Montreal. They come here because it's a very different way to play fly fishing. You know, it just fishes its own way. So it has its, the core reason why it's got its reputation of being that really exciting, different, temperamental East Coast river, that remains. But when you think about the old days where the green drake hatch was blanketing the river, like, we don't get green drakes like that anymore, right? There's certain things that just don't exist. You know, River Road, there's a 7-mile stretch up river that's all very, very flat and oxbowy, and it's excellent flat water fishing, but it's silted in like crazy in the past 10, 11 years from certain flood events, and, you know, it's got a major sedimentation issue, and that didn't exist in the previous generation. So
right. This
is my, to correct the biography I sent you that I need to update, it's actually been 14 years. It's been 14 years since we took the shop over, not 10.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, and I'm in my late 30s, so I'm not an old buck, but just in my tenure here, not even compared to when I was growing up in the river, just in the time period I've owned the store, there's major challenges that have arisen, and some kind of correct themselves, some don't. But I think the reputation of the river, the positives will always be drawing people in, and the negatives are something that all fisheries are experiencing, which is pretty sad, right?
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, there's a guide here in Colorado, a friend of mine who guides on a particular river, and they went in and they, you know, the fisheries people went in and put in a lot of structure, changed it around, put in boulders and stuff, and it changed the whole river, you know? And so, you know, he went back there the next year, he says, I had to relearn this whole river because it's like a totally new river. And
totally.
Long term, it's supposed to be good because they had some of the same issues you may have, which is, you know, silt and things like that. And so, you know, long term, it will probably be better. But for the moment, it's a little disconcerting.
Well, exactly. And, you know, we've got an organization in town, the Au Sable Freshwater Center. It used to be Au Sable River Association, but they're growing into a broader mission. So they have a wonderful approach to these, and they're in the river fixing it for many reasons, right? Development in a floodplain is going to cause issues in the watershed, right? So there's a lot of ice jams and a lot of roadside development that has caused the river to act in ways that are, you know, have drastic negative impacts on the community from flooding and stuff like that. So a lot of their work is mitigating flood risks and ice jams, and inherently that work, because now you have a healthier river, will provide you the habitat and the structure you need for healthy trout habitat, right? So if you start backwards and move toward a healthy river, you're going to end up with an ecosystem that can support life, as opposed to going in there and just like digging a hole and putting some rocks up so trout have a place to stay. They kind of look at it more from the bottom up, I suppose. And I think that's a cool approach, because it's not just about trout and catching fish. It's about the health of the river. And those needs to be identified before you can have a healthy trout population. So it all kind of goes hand in hand. But anyway,
it's interesting too, because you have to balance in, you know, humans into the equation. I was just out in Reno, and we were staying in an apartment up on the 14th floor in downtown Reno, and looking right down on the river. And Reno's done an incredible job there, the Riverwalk area, of putting in structure and so forth. And there's kayaking there. There's looking out the window, I see three fly fishers, you know, fishing the river in downtown Reno, you know.
No way.
But yet, in the same breath, on both sides of the river are huge walls, because they've had, you know, severe flooding there. And they have to keep that river contained. So, you know, they have to balance the health of the city as well as the health of the fish and the river as well. So, yeah, a lot of, like you say, a lot of things come into play. Overall, what's the health of the West Branch of the Au-Sable? Is it generally good?
Generally good. This year was excellent. It was one of those years where the guides and I would be hanging out, and we're, like, all really happy with both how the hatches were this spring, the health of the trout we were catching. You know, East Coast fisheries, you'll hear there's a lot of stocked fisheries on the East Coast, so we look at and pay attention to fish we're catching that aren't clearly stocked, either from that year or previous years. And this year we were catching just way above average, just larger, healthier, strong, really nice fish. So we this spring we were like, oh man, like we were on an up and up from previous seasons, and that was a really, really good thing to see. Certain areas of the river, like I mentioned, that river road, that flatwater stretch, this year I had awesome March Brown hatches, awesome Caddis hatches, big Hendrickson hatches. You know, it all lined up perfectly and predictable, and I was fishing spots I hadn't fished for a while because it just hadn't been productive. And this year, it was on. So yeah, this year it feels great, but then check out what happened. Then you come into July, and then it's 80 degrees, and you don't have a night under 60 for 3.5 weeks, right? So luckily we're able to adapt, because the Adirondacks has a lot of water and different options, but the health of the fishery right now is so determined by the weather pattern, almost to the point where it's like, oh, you had a really healthy winter. It's like, yeah, well, what we need is a cold May and a cold June and a cold evenings in the summer. Like, this, it's not about the snowpack anymore. It's about the weather. It's really about just what weather you're going to have, and there's no predicting that at all. So you're really just at the whim of, like, what the season gives you. Like, right now, it's fall, beautiful weather. We have a very low river right now. We haven't had rain in a couple weeks. Temperatures are good, but the water is very low, very clear. When we get a couple, you know, get a half an inch of rain, holy cow, the fishing turns on. Then the water flushes out, and you're morning and evening, and you have to really get into, you know, you really have to start stalking fish, you know.
So
the river, I'd say, overall healthy, but it's dictated by weather almost 100%.
Everywhere, yeah. We need to take a quick break here, Evan, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Au-Sable in New York. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com. Or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com, 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Evan Botcher about the West Branch of the Au Sable River. If you'd like to ask Evan a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Evan, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world. So, yeah, tell us about your business and anything else you're involved in, you know, that has to do with fly fishing.
Cool. So, yeah, I have the Hungry Trout Fly Shop is a shop here on the Au Sable. The shop here was built in the 90s. 1991 is when my dad built the shop at the Hungry Trout Resort, which is a, you know, 20-unit motel and a restaurant, and we built the fly shop there in 91 and leased it. We always leased it out because it was just, we wanted to get the package in. So we have a, our shop is, we got a motel, restaurant, fly shop on a 9-acre property right on the west branch of the Au Sable. So since I was a kid, that shop was my bus stop. When I would get off the bus, I'd be too young to go to the house. I'd hang out up there, and the old shop managers would keep me entertained or try to anyway. I really wasn't interested in fly fishing when you're like seven, you know what I mean? But that fly shop, it's been there 35 years now. That's not the best math, but 33 years, something like that. We've run it 14. We got a great team of guides, about 8 or 9 guides that work. Most of them are full-time at the Trout, so we do a lot of guiding, a lot of instruction. It's just an amazing situation, you know. It's one of those shops that's not this, like, hey, let's throw our money together and build a shop, and you walk into it, and it feels like an Old Navy. Or, you know, like some of these shops now, they're, like, so merchandised, you're not in that, like, the fly fishing culture anymore. You're in like the Old Navy culture that's just selling fly gear. You know what I mean? I don't know if that's like the right example, but the shop, we're lucky we've grown up in the small fly shop side of things. So you're the character of the town and the staff is really, really shows in the day to day. You know, we're a small shop. We're not super retail oriented. We sell everything and we've got all the top brands and all that, but guiding and the services is really what we do. So up here right now, we've got go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was going to have tell people what your domain name is so that they can find your shop out there.
Yeah, it's hungrytroutflyshop.com. That'll
take
you
one.
Right to our – yeah, Hungry Trout Fly Shop. And then hungrytrout.com will take you to our resort page so you kind of get the idea of where we are. It's just an absolutely jaw-dropping – landscape we live in. We guide fishing every day. We do a lot of guiding. We got, you know, guides cranking out every day. We got multiple trips going out. That's the whole thing up here. It's hanging out with people. It's what the Hungry Trout was founded on. It's not selling junk. It's being with people and introducing them to fishing and going fishing, spending time on the river, fishing on your own time in between trips, just fishing, exploring, fishing, exploring, and hanging. And it's all about the hang up here. You'll hear that a lot. Our head guide, Rachel, is all about the hang. And that perspective, like yesterday, we had a guide trip out, and the freaking conditions were brutal, and they were not having a strong catching day. They couldn't have cared less. These guys were having a blast. They're laughing hard with the guide. Guide comes in the shop and he's like, holy shit, today's brutal. I'm like, dude, look how happy these guys are. Like, they couldn't kill it. They were having a ball. And that's kind of the thing. Like, it's really not, it doesn't always come down at all to the success of the thing. It's all about the hang, having fun, exploring. Like, how lucky are you guys to be doing this, whether we're catching fish or not, you know? And exactly. When you have that attitude, which we really strive to have that, right? It's all about just getting out there, cruising, having fun. The Adirondacks has a lot of little corners in it, so
Looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's not like we're not on one river that you like hit repeat on. Like some of these guides have to guide the same float 100 times in a row. You know, we have a lot of water on foot, so yeah, it's a really cool, easy area. Lodge, the motels, the Adirondacks, cruising around, fishing, instructing, and just having a lot of fun, really.
Good. Now, does it from the old days to today, it has this area been a destination area more so for people to come there to vacation?
Yeah, the Adirondacks were put on the map as like the first destination vacation region from people coming out of New York City. And you'd have, some of the first people to travel here were outdoorsmen for hunting and fishing. And, as you said, it really stands out as a destination for outdoorsmen, and they recognized that from a very early on, like early 1800s, late 1700s. People were up here fishing and trapping. Of course, the Adirondacks have been fallen victim to a lot of industry over the years, but it because of which it was like the first like vacation destination from people traveling, needing a weekend away from New York
Yeah.
City. So
Yeah, cool.
yeah,
Cool. Yeah, it sounds like it. So yeah, 'cause and that was quite a trek back in those days from New York City.
oh yeah
Yeah,
yeah
probably took a train up there to a certain point, I expect. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's a question in from John in New York. He says, "I understand that the last couple of years there's been a serious high stream temperature issue during the summer months. If true, how impactful has that been?" And you kind of talked to this a few minutes ago.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
about, yeah.
what it does, I wouldn't say, and this is what's funny too. I have to preface this. We always talk about, we don't have temperature logs in our river. And when I was growing up, even 10 years ago when we first took the shop over, this temperature conversation we had, it was not a conversation in the mainstream, right? So we know that the rivers were certainly colder, of course, but was our river in 2007 74 degrees in the middle of July? Who knows? No one was really paying attention to that. You know what I'm saying? Now temperature is like a focal point because it's now like something that we're seeing in a lot of different areas. So now water temp. So it's, did we used to fish all summer long because the water was colder, or we just weren't paying attention to the fact that it got over 70? Or,
Right.
that was not a conversation when I was growing up at all. But pretty interesting to just reflect on. And as
Yeah.
far as the temperatures, like last year, these last 2 years he mentioned, last year we actually had extremely good temperatures. It was a very wet and a very cold summer. So, and that's why we think this year we had such a healthy population, because in those low water, high heat summers, that's, we're guessing, when you lose most of your fish. Not in the winter when the water's cold. It's in the summer when it's too hot and gets too low. So that's, we were all thinking maybe that's the reason. This summer it got really hot, but we had a ton of water because it rained all the time. So right now is the lowest water we've had of the whole season. This summer we were above average flows. Even though it was warm, we had a lot of water, thank God.
What
But yeah, go ahead, sorry.
do the levels and flow conditions impact your fishing or the productivity on the river?
Oh,
I mean,
100%. Yeah, there's
okay.
like any stream will have its sweet spot. Our main stem gauge, we want to fish it like ideally it's like 450 to 1,000 CFS, which you can divide that by half for the West Branch because that's below the confluent. We don't have
Oh.
just the West Branch gauge, so it's all relative to the main stem gauge.
Okay.
So we watch that. So yeah, we have an absolute sweet spot. When it's too low, the fish get weary and retract into deeper pools and heavy cover, and they just are a lot less likely to pounce on your fly, right? And high water is awesome. It just gets dangerous waiting because it's a steep river. So we've got a sweet spot of flows. Summer is normally not it. We really shift off of the off-label in the summer, outside of like people who learn that we're doing a lot of like training with will fish the off-label, but we're not like on the off-label like taking many people out to like chase trout. We do that from like 6 to 10 in the morning, and that's it. So, or we're going brook trout fishing, which we have an absolute ton of beautiful little blue line streams. So yeah, summers are difficult. We absolutely, on those low hot summers, we absolutely lose fish. To what extent, it's hard to measure, but there's, we'll find them. Like fish kills when the river's 80 degrees and hardly moving. Like, it happens very rarely, but it doesn't help the fishery, put it that way.
Yeah. We got a question in on the internet here from Matt McGraw in Covington, Virginia. He says, how does it fish in November and December in and around Wilmington?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can extend that and kind of talk about, you know, the seasons and if
Right.
any regulations affect the seasonal aspect of it. Maybe you can speak to that too.
Yeah, of course. Our fishery, April through October, is our target time period. April can be quite cold and still not really turned on yet, but out of our area, we have about four or five watersheds that we fish. The earliest ones turn on in April, and they all shut off by the end of October. And a part of that, too, is the weather really turns to crap, and we can continue to fish in November, but that's also when the brown trout start spawning. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go to these rivers where the bite's on. New York State does not have regulations against fishing on the spawn, which is wrong. You go to Colorado, right, and you're not allowed to fish X feet from any incoming stream, and they have spawning areas identified, and they don't in New York. But we just know, yeah, we could fish a little bit later, but we don't. We generally cut it down end of October, early November, and wait and then get ready for April. So November, December fishing is really definitely not something
in the cards.
I travel from.
Yeah.
Not in the cards. Not from coming from Virginia, right? Like,
yeah.
You live locally and you get a good weather window, no question. But it's our destination time period is like May and June, September and October. The summer is nice if you're coming up for the 100 other reasons to come to the Adirondacks. But if you're coming for fishing, those 4 months are easily the prime time.
Okay. What species or trout do you fish for in the Au-Sable?
The Au-Sable and our surrounding waters, our nice fish are going to be brown. We're generally brown. The state stocks some rainbows mostly, but they don't take on as well as the browns. The browns is where you'll catch your wild fish will be browns. Your stronger, larger, much older fish are generally browns. But we also, in our smaller streams, we catch a lot of native brook trout. That's kind of our, you know, kind of like the East Coast mountain gem, right, is native brook trout. So that's our go-to, and we've got a ton of amazing little creeks for that as well. And what's funny about those, because they're, like, everyone's like, oh, I want to go brook trout fishing. We're like, excellent. They're like, where should I go? And it's like crickets, you know. No, like those sort of creeks are like more coveted than any fishing spot on the West Branch, you know.
Okay.
It's pretty funny because they are very susceptible to pressure. And
you
know, if we have eight guides, they're all going brook trout fishing. I don't know where one of them's going,
yeah.
You know. And they're my buddies. They're like good buddies.
Yeah.
So it's funny.
Okay, are there any specific regulations that anglers need to be aware of when fishing the Au-Sable?
On the Au-Sable, there's 7 miles of catch and release. That catch and release section's year-round. The rest of the river, you know, you got about 20 miles of catch and keep. You can keep 5 trout up to, or 12 inches or over. I think I haven't caught a trout in a long time, but and then after October 15th, the whole watershed comes catch and release. So nothing ever closes. It just all turns catch and release prior to April and after October 15th.
Okay.
And, you know, another thing to add, which people remind me of all the time that I take for granted, is the amount of public access that we have in our watersheds here are like it's above and beyond most places. There's an 11-mile stretch between Lake Placid, New York, which is, you know, where the Olympics were, and it's got the little downtown street, and everyone from Wilmington calls it Lake Plastic because we're better than them, you know. And, that 11-mile stretch from Lake Placid to Wilmington is the catch-and-release area. It's very steep. It's just picturesque pocket water. It's all public. So you have like 11-mile stretch. You can drive up and down this road and park literally anywhere you want and pop out and fish without having to worry about any private property or anything. It's all state land fishing access for 11 miles.
Mm-hmm.
That parallels the river. That doesn't include the lower 20 miles, which is also like scattered with public access all over the place. So there's so many miles of river to fish that even when it does get busy and we're in our peak season, you can pull a map out and be by yourself like in no time.
Okay. Does can you kind of because we started to talk about this, can you kind of give us a tour down the West Branch? I don't know if you want to start from the confluence or at the headwaters, but can you kind of walk us down the different sections? And also, you know, we talked before the show about a map. Maybe you can direct people to a map like you
Yes,
told me about.
absolutely. If you go to hungrychoutflyshop.com and scroll down a little ways, there's a really neat picture of a West Branch Off-Stable map with a little contact form. Just throw your address in there, and we mail out these maps all the time because they're free. They're really cool. It costs us a stamp to get it out to you. And we're happy to send you guys these little maps. They're super cool, and it gives you kind of a lay of the land, picturesque little, things for your glove box when you're here fishing. We do have like maps for sale, but they're not as cool. These are neat little,
That's fine.
advertising kind of. Yeah, they're classic. They're really neat. But if you throw one there, you'll see a picture of it, and we're happy to drop one in the mail for you. And
Oh,
the West
yeah.
Branch, take a tour of the West Branch. So we've got it's a cool river in that it's quite a few little like mini rivers. Because if you have a 30-foot waterfall, you've got this impassable barrier, right? So you'll have like these little you have these areas in the river that there's like a 30-foot waterfall, and then a mile up is another 30-foot waterfall. So you have like a mile and a half, like little mini ecosystem that stockfish can only get to by getting washed over a waterfall, big one, right? So it's like there's a lot of these like little like pockets throughout the river that make it change quite a bit. So the upper section coming out of Mount Marcy and the high peaks, the confluence of South Meadow and Marcy Brook is what begins the West Branch of the Off-Sable. In that area, it's a very clear river, very little tannins. What a 3 foot deep hole looks like it's 8 inches because it's so clear, And that kind of tumbles down and out in a small stream because the biggest tributary to the West Branch is the Chub River. And it picks up the Chub River just below the Olympic ski jump as you're leaving Lake Placid. So once it meets the Chub, you're on a stretch we call River Road, which is about 7 miles of meandering oxbowy sand bank, real quiet and beautiful flat water. Excellent dry fly fishing when it's on. I normally don't fish there very much unless I know there's going to be some dry fly activity because it's not the most eventful water if you're not having fish working, right? So that's about, we have about 7 miles of that, and some of it's really gorgeous. You get little tribs coming in and big oxbowy with overhung trees and down timber. Gorgeous. That eventually you'll get to, and you'll see it on the map, you've got all these oxbows, and then what happens? It plunges about 3,000 vertical feet, 2,500 vertical feet in the next 20 miles. So the river really just drops, and it picks up a lot of speed and gradient and just plunges down for the next like 12, 13 miles before it reaches any sort of flat stretch of river. That's like the catch and release and the notch area. And that's like really, the vertical release when you're in the river, you're looking up at the top of a mountain that's 3,500 feet above you. So it's the same sort of elevation relief that you see if you're skiing in Colorado, and you're at the base of if you're and you're at the base lodge and you're looking up at these big Rockies. You know what I'm saying? Like we're fishing at like 1,000 vertical feet, and the mountain behind us is 4,600.
Yeah,
So
nice.
it's dramatic, right? Like you're looking straight up at the tree line, at the horizon line of the mountains. And that stretch in there is carved right down the center of that. So there's 100-foot cliffs on the sides of the river, really, really shaded, really steep. And like there's like little holes that are like the size of a Volkswagen that are 8 feet deep. And then it's shallow with boulders and another pool the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, right? Just like little pockets that you have to kind of crawl around over to. You're not going to hear anyone say that the West Branch is easy wading. In fact, like you talk about its reputation, like it's like probably the thing it's most known for is that it's like a pretty gritty hike getting to and from and around the water. waitstaffs are always necessity, right? And this is the kind of the area that gave it that reputation, you know?
Okay.
The catch and release area between Lake Placid and Wilmington is easily the most fish. It's one of the steepest, and it's just all bowling balls and boulders and, you know, tough to get around, say the least.
Well, that's something I want to have you point out, because we're down to Wilmington now, basically. As far
we're just about down to like Whiteface Mountain. The ski center is right before you get into, is right at the like beginning of Wilmington. And at that ski center, you get into, start getting into some series of some pretty major waterfalls around that region.
I see here on my map the Flume Fall. Are we
exactly
that far down yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're almost. So right above the Whiteface. Yep, right above Whiteface, we've got the High Falls Gorge, and there's a series of 30-footers in there. Then that comes down, runs underneath the Whiteface Ski Center, which is an excellent area to fish. It's one of the higher fish densities in the region. It's got some really nice cold creeks that come off the mountain. So that's a really good area. And that that's a mile upstream of the Hungry Trout.
Okay.
So now we're in the backyard of our resort here. And our resort is smack dab in the middle of the watershed. We have about 12 miles upstream, 12 miles down. So it's equal distant for us to get downriver as it is upriver. And that makes it awesome. So we fish a lot on the lower river, where a lot of other outfitters that are coming from out of town, that's double the distance for them to fish the lower river. Mm. So we're really nicely situated to explore the whole watershed without it being like a time sink to get to it. So the Hungry Trout's like right in the middle. Upstream is, you know, steep, classic, catch and release, regulated, like what everybody thinks of as your fly fishing zone, right? But that's because that's like the catch and release protected area.
Okay.
From the Hungry
Trout.
We've
got, you know, a lot of people listening are, you know, baby boomers like me that may not wade as well as we once did. Is there a place for older folks where the wading isn't so intense?
And that's where I like to come into this. And I'm always like the guy arguing the fact that it's a difficult wading river. Because I'm like, well, what the hell are we doing in the river anyway? You know, like what you need to be doing is standing a foot away from the shore, fishing the deep pockets that are right in front of you, right? And if wading is difficult, you just work up the shoreline and you're dabbing in the pockets that are close to shore. You're not like walking out into the middle of the river. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
There's a lot of ways to read a river, both on a map and with the help of your local fly shop. It's like, hey, here's an awesome pool. It's in the middle of pocket water, but this is an inside bend with sand and gravel where you can stand. There's a bunch of those, you know. So it's not like it's all this treachery pocket water. It has that structure, but that doesn't mean that the banks aren't forgiving for a lot of easy access. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah, okay.
Yeah, we've got a lot of aging anglers that have been coming to us for decades now. There's guys that are still coming to the fly shop that were there when I was getting off the school bus. And they're coming up and fishing it. They can't fish all the places they used to, right? But it's absolutely big enough, and it has enough variety of water where, you know, you're not going to show up there and have nowhere to go or not have the opportunity to catch her. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Let's finish up here. And on your tour here.
Yeah. So from the Hungry Trout sits right above the Flume Falls. So if you walk outside the Hungry Trout Resort, it's kind of a shallower area of pocket water. It's a 1 mile stretch to get up to the Whiteface area from our lodge. So you walk out back of the motel, you're on the river, you've got a mile fishing till you get to Whiteface. And then if you go downriver, right behind the resort, there's a series of waterfalls. There's like a 15-foot waterfall, a 30-foot waterfall, and then a 20-foot waterfall. We call that the Flume Falls. And it's a gorge right behind the trout. Fantastic, big cliff walls, swimming area, but it's just amazing fishing as well. And at the base of that, there's actually a dammed up section down below, and that flume section spills out into what we call Lake Everest. It's a dammed up section of the Au Sable, so it's another mile and a half of flat water, much more of a river structure. It's called Lake Everest, but there's like, you know, maybe a quarter mile that's wider than 100 feet. You know, it's not like a big, it's not like a lake. It's just a quiet water stretch, you know what I'm saying? And that's really nice, too, because that's one of those little ecosystems I mentioned earlier, because on one end there's a dam, and at the top end is a 30-foot waterfall, and there's a deep kind of lake-ish structure. So you'll find types of fish in there and activity of fish moving from the lake back into the river and back that you don't really have in other sections, because it's just like a special little two-mile little micro habitat, you know.
Okay.
And there's a couple like that, and it's like below the Wilmington Dam too, right below the Lake Everest. There's a nice dam that's wide, river wide. There's some really nice metal sculptures of some flies that Fran Betters tied up by the road, and from that dam down you've got another like 6 miles of pocket water, very uniform pocket water, not huge pools, but nice pools. And if you can read water, it's super fishy, just like trout habitat. Oh, there, look at that rock, look at that rock, look at that rock. And that goes for quite a while. Also a little micro habitat, because those fish in the summer months will run up river and they'll hit that dam. So you have like this dam that is another impediment that the has a relationship with the fish that live in that area that use that dam for both refuge and the attempt at spawning, you know what I'm saying?
So, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a really, that has its own little personality, and how to read that and how to, the nuance of that stretch of river is very different from 50 feet above it, because it's a just different structure and different personality. So it's you know, just highlighting that it's different and it's really unique, and each stretch really does operate in its own little way. And from the Wilmington Dam down to the confluence, it's pretty uniform. It's steep. It's pocket water. There's not a lot of flat water down there. But it also runs into one last gorge, 15-foot waterfall. And this gorge is about half a mile long. The walls are probably 75 feet, 100 feet tall. And it is jaw-dropping. Quick story about that. I got to throw it in there. Years ago, when I was growing up, my whole life, up to about 8 years ago, when my son was 2, he's 10 now, there was a dam in that gorge. That gorge was dammed up. It had like a 40-foot tall dam on the tail end, and it was all dammed up. It was a lake, and there were big smallmouth bass in there. People were deep enough where you, and long enough where you actually put a canoe in, and you'd paddle down into this gorge to fish. And the Au Sable River Association, now the Au Sable Freshwater Center, in partnership with the town of Jay and Au Sable, got X millions of dollars to remove this dam, because dam removal is a big thing. This is an old dam that was decrepit. Why fix it? It was falling down. Boom, they took it out. And I would go there with my son to watch these huge tractors dig in and pull this dam down, and, you know, big jackhammers on a tractor. And my son and I watched this lake get dug up and the dam blown out. We watched in real time this canyon just show up out of nowhere. And the river bottom, like, you know, we would come back day after day. And we went back the one day when they were done, and the dam was gone, and the river structure had taken hold. The gravel had filled in, and the river structure at the bottom of this thing. And I cried. It was unbelievable to see what had been buried underneath this lake, and because of this dam, which used to be a paper mill in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. So the infrastructure on both sides of the river down there, there's pipes you could drive through just rotting away, and you don't even know they're there. You move some leaves away, and you're like, oh, my God, this is like a huge metal, like, discharge pipe from the lot, from the paper mill. But it's all grown in because it's over 150 years old. Right?
Yeah.
That's the kind of like history I'm talking about. But watching that dam get dug out, I mean, so then, you know, 2 days later, I go in there and I'm fishing it. And in my head, I'm looking back. I go home, I open the book, and I'm thinking, okay, Ray Bergman wrote about this river in the book Trout. Theodore Gordon helped develop some of his flies here and wrote about the Quill Gordon was, like, influenced by the region. Fran Betters, you know, Hall of Fame fly tire who grew up here. I mean, it goes on. Art Flick, Lee Wolf. All of these people played around in this river in the 150 years before me. None of them were able to fish that chasm because it was underwater.
Wow.
I might have been, who knows? I don't know if I was first or what, but I was definitely top 10 of the first people to ever cast a fly ever in that stretch of river, because prior to this area being a fishing destination, that dam had been there long before anyone was up here, you know, scouting the river on fly.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That dam was there before any of those dudes got here. It's pretty crazy to think about that, you know, that day and age, there's still rivers like buried in an old industry. It was just mind-boggling. Anyway, from there, you're pretty much at the confluence. That spills right out to where it meets the main branch. But yeah, man, that has changed my perspective on all river infrastructure that particularly is not being used anymore. But it was fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic.
And you know, out west, we got our share of dams that a lot of them are coming out on the Snake, you know, which is really, really, really good to see. You know, just so the salmon can run up river, you know, let them do their thing.
It's not terrible.
We got a question on the internet from Kathy Williams. Is there parking access all along the areas that you've talked about? Easy to
completely
park in?
Everywhere.
Okay.
And, you know, people will be like, oh, river's busy. I'm like, why? Oh, well, there's cars everywhere. I'm like, okay, you have a car in one eye, you have a fisherman in the other. What about 100 yards down from him? Was anyone there?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't see any cars. It's like, okay, so park and walk. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, people think, they think it's busy because there's like 10 cars on the road because the parking spots are full. And I'm like, you know, there's only two people per car. That means there's 20 people between you and 11 miles. Up river, you know.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of parking. You see somebody, you can just leapfrog them up the road a ways. It's not congested parking to where you're like, there's like cars everywhere. The pool is like, it's laid out really nicely, so it's not like a congested fishing vibe at all. There's not many like shared parking lots for fishing. Like, this hole will have a little pull-off. This hole will have a little pull-off. It's really, it very naturally happened. The state did not put the parking lot there. They all happened kind of organically, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, cool. Let's talk about flies and the hatches that are going on in the rivers. It sounds, after you've described the topography and the falls and the little micro sections that you're fishing, it sounds to me that it could be quite different in the different parts of the river.
Absolutely.
What John Ferguson says, what's your favorite hatch? And maybe we'll just use that as a lead in to talk about what are the different hatches and how does that change, you know, throughout the river?
Yeah, so the different sections have their own sort of routine, right? Historically, upriver, where the river road, that flatwater area, kind of has its own, how it hatches and when is different than down. But if we're in Hendrickson season, there'll be Hendricksons everywhere. But the timing and kind of how the hatch unfolds will be unique based on whether it's flat water or heavy pocket water, et cetera. My favorite hatch has got to be the Hendrickson, just because it's always the first one. It's currently, in this era we're in, it's the most prolific. And while it's happening, you also mix in a bunch of the first caddis hatches. You've got your transition into your March Browns, and all of that sort of comes together. But the Hendrickson is first, and that's, to this day, that's the most predictable hatch, where you have a sky full of mayflies, the spinner fall. You go from emergers to duns to spinners, emerger. Like, if you really go through the whole hatch with the Hendrickson and the March Brown and with the caddis, right? That, those things really exist in full cycles. The Stonefly is also probably one of our most popular insects as a whole. It's not like, you know, stoneflies don't hatch like mayflies do, where you have like a whole sky full of them. You get clouds here and there, of course, but it's more just like a really dominant hatch. You'll see the shucks on the rocks. They're all over the place. You see them flying, but a little more sporadic. But that hatch and those bugs is what allow us to use pretty much the size 8, 10, and 12 attractor dry flies like all summer. We're using big chubby Chernobyls, big Aufsable wolves and Aufsable bombers that are, you know, they're like easily an inch and a half long. Stimulators in size 6s and 8s. Big flies, you know. Our nymphs are size 6s, stonefly nymphs, size 8, girdle bugs, and we're using 4.3 or 3.8 mil beads to get down in the plunge pool. So the stoneflies permit us to use a really user-friendly assortment of flies, you know.
Hmm. Yeah.
And they're right at the tail end of the March browns as well. So we'll go Hendrickson's with your Granums, your caddis in there. Then you'll go into your March browns. Your March browns will be coupled with some sulfurs, which isn't a super strong hatch anymore, but you still have to have your cream bodies and your pale yellow bodies. We use a lot of attractor flies for these, white wolf, royal wolf, parachute atoms, but in your sizes like 10 and 12. So if you're here for a hatch and you think, oh, that's a 16, use a 14. If it's really heavy water, use a 12. As long as it's remotely, honestly, like you can use pretty absurd stuff in pocket water. It's very opportunistic fishing, you know.
Yeah, we have I want to throw this kind of question comment in here from Matt McGraw. He left an earlier question. He's from Virginia. He says, I fished the West Branch for a week 2 years ago, and I loved it. I was there in May and was shocked by the size of the flies that the local fly shop recommended. I fished size 8 and 10 dries all week, and even some recommended a size 6. Do you also fish larger than usual nymphs and streamers? So that's just what you just described.
Oh, that's cool. And it's great because people come up from like Pennsylvania and they don't have something that's a size 8. I mean, Pennsylvania, they've got some stonefly hatches down there, you know, but it's not like, it doesn't like determine their whole fly box.
Yeah.
So like the nymphs too, and because it's pocket water, same thing. You're like, oh, it's a Hendrickson hatch, but it's 3 p.m. and nothing's hatching. I need to fish a nymph. It's like, I'll use a size 12 or 14. And then if I need to start sizing down, I will. But when I hit the pocket water, like if they're on mayflies, I just, no matter what mayfly it is, I just pick like a size 12 mayfly imitation and it'll crush. It's not a river where like, oh, well, this one only has two fibbits. I need three. This abdomen only has 4 segments, you know. It's not that, but it can be in the flat and when you get low water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's not like technical fishing or a complex hatch doesn't exist. It absolutely does.
Okay.
And we're ready for that. Like, I have a very technical hatch box on me, but when I'm just going out fishing, like, oh, I'm just going to hit the river, I'm going out there with 4X tippet and a size 8 stimulator, right? And then I'll resort back to the hatch routine and the realistic routine as needed.
Okay.
But my first approach is with larger attractor, much more forgiving bugs, and I'll do a dry dropper, and then I'll do a dry, keep my stimulator on, but I'll fish my Griffith gnat or my trico or my blueing olive as my dropper behind my stimmy or my chubby. That's a great way to fish rough water with a fly that is very hard to see in rough water. So little tricks like that to present small bugs and a finicky drift is just fishing as a dropper. So
yeah, I want you to answer his question about nymphs, but hold that. Let me do my quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about the nymphs. So hang tight, and we'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Evan Butcher about West Branch of the Au Sable River. If you'd like to ask Evan a question, go to our homepage, put it in there, and send it over, and we'll see if we can't get it answered here yet tonight. Okay, yeah, so Matt had asked, do you also fish larger than usual nymphs and streamers?
We do. Streamers is a little different, but the nymphs, absolutely. Just the rule of thumb, just like the dries, just size up one or two, depending on how rough and what the flow is and all, you know, once you consider the conditions, you can size up all day long. If it's low and it's more realistic, you're going to have to get more realistic. But if the river is, you know, full and turbulent, you can sneak by with some much bigger nymphs. And our nymphs too, quickly, we tie them a lot with tungsten, and we're tying them heavier because we want a plungy fly. We want it to hit and sink. We don't have time for it to drift 4 or 5 feet in order to get to depth. We need it to plunge into the zone. So we use a lot of heavier beads. So if you're tying on a trip up there or any pocket water, you want to tie it up with a little extra weight to get into the strike zone as fast as you can.
Yeah, and Phil McCartney in Kentucky also asked about the effectiveness of streamers, and you said there's a place for those?
Oh, I love streamer fishing. I do a lot of tight lining. You know, it was tight lining, then it became Euro nymphing, and it has a whole assortment, right? So we do a lot of just high sticking, whether you're using a longer Euro nymph rod or just fishing close by. And streamer fishing is great in pocket water for that reason, because you can high stick your streamer, you know, not a long cast, 15 feet, nice easy roll cast away. It lands in the pocket, and when you're close to it, you can just use your rod tip and kind of bounce the streamer through the pocket. And then look at another pocket. Okay, same length of line, bada bing, bada boom, splash behind the pocket. Use your rod tip, twitch, 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 twitch. So you don't have to, like, cast across the river, strip back across the river. Get all that line back out. Get it all back in. Get it all back out, you know? So you can fish pocket water with the streamer very efficiently without it being, like, so annoying like streamer fishing can be for people, right? So because of which, I have streamers 100% of the time on my chest pouch. So when I'm fishing up the river or any pocket water river, if I put a nice nymph, perfect drift through a hole, dry fly through a hole, nothing's coming. I switch fly or two, nothing. I will 100% of the time put a streamer through that pocket. I don't care what or when it is. I know there's a fish that lives there and it's not eating dries or nymphs. I'm going to give it some sort of streamer presentation, right? And regardless of conditions, some conditions are way better for streamers than other, but you'd be blown away at the conditions you get an attack from, because if it's low water, they're very territorial. If it's high water, they're probably used to chasing food. I fish streamers a lot.
Okay.
David. I like it. You know, go ahead.
Yeah. It sounds like a unique way to do that and very effective. David Cordian in California asks, do you ever use a skating dry fly on the Au Sable, or are the dry flies only presented in dead drift?
No. We use a lot of moving flies. I think when you know about flies, you start recognizing that, like, for instance, right now, the Isonychia nymph, our slate drake, is a very fast-swimming insect. So is a caddis. So is a blooming dolly. So in pocket water, you'll see fish just jumping out of the river, and you're like, what the heck is that? We know what it is. It's these fish chasing emergers, and they're jumping out of the water because they don't know that the water ends above the bug. So people come in like, what is that? And they haven't caught fish. Skittering, what we call it, skittering or skating, is exactly the technique to catch those fish. So the Aufsable bomber, you know, like a salmon bomber, one of Fran Better's classic ties is an Aufsable bomber, which is a 2XL hook with woodchuck tail, a fully palmered body with ginger and grizzly hackle, and one high forward half-tail wing, just like a bomber for salmon, except it's tied as a trout size with hackle and calf tail instead of deer hair. And we skitter that thing like crazy. It is meant for that. It was designed to be a skittered and stonefly trying to take off. So you mix all of those moving insects that we have, couple that with stoneflies that have a really hard time getting off the water. We have fish devouring skittered flies like all spring. Not even in spring. 2 weeks ago, I had a guide trip, and we were skittering golden, it's called a, not a white walker, but it's called like a widow walker from Montana Fly Company. We were skittering that. We were catching browns like crazy like 2 weeks ago. And it was only when you were like skating this foam across. So very okay. long-winded answer to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I could have just said yes.
Go do it. Yeah. No, I appreciate the detail. That helps people a lot.
Yeah. Well, I want to remind everybody too that I also worked like a 10-hour fly shop shift earlier, and I talked about all of this like 12 hours already today. So if I'm like just mindlessly going on, it's because I'm not fully conscious anymore. But it's great.
Okay.
I'm into it.
Okay. We don't have far to go here, Evan. Only 20 more minutes.
Man, it's all good.
Only 10 more minutes for you, so 9 now.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
What role does stealth play on the West branch?
You know, I'm in the middle of a debate about that, to be honest. Because of the structure of the river, you don't think you need to be that stealthy, and you kind of don't. I mean, I'm not a small guy. I'm like, 6 foot, and I run around pretty heavy in the river, and I catch fish, right? So, but with that said, stealth always helps. If you can just kind of, you don't have to like creep up to fish. It's very tannic and it's very turbulent. So compared to many rivers, you don't have to like crawl around or anything like that.
Okay.
But Roger, believe it or not, I have another quick story. Do we have time for one more?
Sure, it has to be less than 10 minutes, though.
it'll be less than 2 minutes. But it comes into play because this stealth conversation, I just had a conversation today. It blew my mind. This our head guide friend lives in Washington, and she takes GoPro cameras and she puts them underwater and she videotapes these steelheads. And she goes back a couple hours later and gets her GoPro and she like looks at him and says, "Hey, that's cool." And that woman apparently looks at the footage. And one of the biggest takeaways she got from it is that the footage of her GoPro, which is 3 feet underwater, captured the sound of her walking through the snow to get to the riverbank. And it also captured the sound of an airplane flying overhead while the GoPro was underwater. So,
and this was 3 feet underwater, you said?
3 feet underwater, and the GoPro picked up the sound of an airplane, and it picked up the sound of her walking through the snow to get to the side of the river.
Wow.
So, yeah,
that's telling. Why I'm like. It's telling, yeah.
Oh, it's telling. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm catching fish. Would I catch more if I was more stealthy? Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and sometimes you're on the river, you can't, your buddies, a few yards up the river, and you can't even hear each other talk, because the river's making so much noise. So you want, it kind of makes you think, well, maybe it's more visual, but I'm sure it's a combination of both always, visual and auditory,
No question.
What they hear. And you said it earlier, and I hear this from every one of my guests, I swear, unless you're out in the boat fishing the salt, is don't step in the river, fish it first, right? And everybody says that, and every time I go out fishing, I watch people walk up to the river, and they walk right in, That's probably the biggest tip we could ever get, and the one that people ignore the most, from my experience.
Learn how to read the water.
Do you, you talked about fishing nymphs, tight lining. Do you ever, is there any place for an indicator, you know, on the West Branch?
Oh, yeah, always. I think on all rivers and all elements, indicators in different sizes and applications are essential to a fly angler's kit. On the West Branch, what's tough about it is you have a lot of small pockets and it's really broken up water, so you don't have like nice long drifts with an indicator. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you don't have the ability to like throw it up there, mend it, get it situated, have the fly and indicator and everything get to the type of drift you want. Because by the time that all happens, your indicator's out of the pocket anyway. So
yeah,
we fish a lot of dry dropper to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or
okay.
if we're gonna fish like a if we're gonna fish a nymph that's much heavier than a dry, or if we need to get deeper, then we'll tight line it, or we'll use a couple different indicator rigs that, you know, kind of combat the small pocket.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
They're not very finesse rigs, I'll tell you that. But, you know, you make it happen. Ideally, you're comfortable enough to tight line it and just kind of high stick it. I also use those stick-on Pulsa indicators, the Orvis stick-ons, Lightning Strike stick-ons, whichever one. They're extremely lightweight. They're tiny. I love them. They're way more of an indicator as opposed. They're not like a bobber or a suspension rig. They're
a
classic. Yeah, just like a nice classic stick-on little foam indicator. Tells you where your fly is. Tells you how your drag is, but it's not suspending your flies. Like a bobber would. Right. It's much more actually for strike detection. And those fit in the pocket water excellent.
Because you get visual indicator is what you've got there, not like you say a suspension device. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, like, where's my nymph and what is it kind of doing, you know? And
that's
all I need from it. And it's funny, like the guys will ask me, like, what'd you catch it on? And Pulsa was one of the brands of the indicators. I think Orvis sells them, but Pulsa was like one of the brands. And I just tell them I caught it on a Pulsa. They don't even ask what nymph. So like, what'd you catch it on? I was like, oh, I caught it on a Pulsa. Like, of course you did. You know?
So Evan, here, I've got a story for you. I'm teaching my wife how to fish. She's finally coming around. She grabbed my grandson's fishing pole the other day down here at the lake. He had a bobber and some power bait on, right? He's only 3 and a half, trying to get him his first fish. He got bored, so she grabbed the rod and goes around to the other side of the lake, throws it out there, and I don't know, 10, 15 minutes later, she comes running around the lake with his fish dangling. I caught a fish, first fish she's ever caught in her life, right? So she brings that along. Then the next time I go out, I try to convert her to a spinner, you know, and say, hey, try this. It's more fun. It's better than just sitting watching this bobber out there. And she goes, okay, I'll do the spinner, but I want the bobber on there too with the power bait. Because she figures that that's the secret. It's the bobber and the power bait. She wants that all with the spinner. I said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. It doesn't work that way. No, that's what I want.
Yeah.
And then we were out camping somewhere, and she lost her bobber, and she goes, you have any more bobbers? And I said, no, but I do have some suspension devices in my vest here. Here, why don't you take one? She goes, that's a bobber.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't pull this woman. She goes, you know, and I go, there you go. It's like, we all tried it. Strike indicator, suspension device, but don't call it a bobber.
No, exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
God.
Then they made them in like white and red, like thingamabobber, made them in white and red to look like a bobber.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. It's crazy stuff. Yeah. Well,
So, I mean, all the tools, all the rigging, they all apply here. You know, it just depends kind of how and what you want to do. Euro nymphing, indicator, dry dropper, big flies. If you're a classic, you want to just fish parachute atoms all day. Like, it's all trout fishing, right? You can really, like, trout or trout still, just because our river has these mechanisms. You can pull it together if you're familiar with trout in general. It's not a tailwater, right? It's a freestone stream. It's like, overall, it's a pretty basic fishery in the fact that it doesn't have like, oh, you need mysis shrimp, or
right,
you need,
right.
you know, or if you're not in a size 14 with a pale body, you're not going to catch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But like, it sounds like you've got to bring your full toolbox, because you don't know
what
you're going to need. Nope. Adapt.
And it's
Adapt.
adapt. And it's the river structure that dictates that, in my opinion. Like,
Right.
everywhere I
Yeah.
go, it's the river you're fishing. The trout are going to be dictated. How they act is dictated by what the river gives them, how the river gives it to them, and when. That's how the trout react, right? The trout
Yeah.
don't dictate how they feed. The river does.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that, because that makes, like, it's not about the trout. You could take trout and put them anywhere, and how are they going to behave? How the river tells it to, you know?
Exactly.
And
Yeah,
I
yeah.
love that. I love that. That really just makes it a bigger picture thing for me, you know?
Well,
So.
we'll end with that, Evan, because we've run out of time here, but all kinds of great tips and information about the West Branch of the Au-Sable tonight. But hang with me, because we're going to give away some prizes. We're going to give a 1-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And we're going to give away those dozen flies that will catch all the fish on the West Branch of the Au-Sable, courtesy of the Hungry Trout Fly Shop. So you know they're good flies, folks. So play with us here in the next few minutes, and maybe you'll win those flies from the Hungry Trout Fly Shop. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flat fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure. Evan, you're making a lot of noise on me.
Sorry.
Okay. From protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they still need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You'll find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on winning one of these great prizes. The first thing we're going to give away is a 1-year membership to the Fly Fishers International. To find more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, and there you can learn all about them. It's a great organization to support and be part of. So if you don't win tonight, go join. And it looks like our winner for that is Chantel Lutsky. Chantel Lutsky in Colorado. So Chantel, congratulations. And we will contact you after the show to get you set up for your membership. And also, we're giving away a 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org, another great organization to support. And our winner there is Bob Younger in Indiana. Bob Younger. So congratulations, Bob. I know Bob's been a longtime listener. I recognize the name. So congratulations to both of you. And now we're giving away a dozen of the hottest flies on the West Branch of the Au-Sable River, courtesy of Hungry Trout Fly Shop. So you have to answer my question on the home page, same place you could ask questions during the show. And the question is going to be a two-part question. One is, what are the prime fishing months or season for the West Branch, from when to when? And what's the first hatch that comes off on the Au-Sable that Evan gets excited about? So two-part question. Got to get both parts right to win. Go ahead and submit those on the homepage there in that box, and we'll see if we can't get a winner here, Evan. Do you think that's going to be easy or hard, Evan? Easy for you.
You
You've
know,
only mentioned it 60 times today,
yeah, but
right?
it's not, we hardly touched on it during this, the coming months. They're either already familiar or they were listening carefully, so.
Yeah, well, I've long given up on, what's the best fly or something like that, because people get it too. And here we go. I think we've got it. April to October and a Hendrickson. That's spot on or what?
Wait, and rephrase your question. What exactly did you ask? Because I think that might be a little too vague.
Oh, well, that was the answer I was going for.
Okay.
Yeah, I
the
said
best
what
season.
the best season, yeah.
Okay.
From when to when,
Okay.
and then yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
You can.
No, that does get it. My reflection on that is the best season is like spring, fall, May. I was looking more for like May or June or September, October.
Oh, yeah, no, just
you know?
The span. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
best season, the best season, that's our whole season. But hey, count it.
Yeah.
They were still listening.
Yeah, and he got it right then, as far as what I was looking for anyway, and that's Bob Younger. So he's a double winner tonight. He won in the drawing, and he's won on the a challenge here at the end. So,
awesome.
Bob, send me your, in the same place you just answered the question, send me your address so I can get that over to Evan, and he can send you out that dozen flies. And then you have to go visit Evan and stay at his nice resort. So that's the consequence of winning tonight, Bob. So
yeah.
Anyway,
sorry, Bob.
Yeah. Sorry you have to do that, Bob, but somebody's got to do
expensive,
it.
Expensive free raffle.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Evan, for sticking with me. I know it's late out there, and you probably have an early morning start, so I'm going to let you go. But it was a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for sharing all your valuable information on the West Branch of the Yosemite.
No, Roger, yeah, my pleasure. Happy to share. Good to get the word out there from, you know, a lot of East Coast people listen, but to talk to folks that are from outside the corridor, it's fun to represent, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's the idea, is let people know about new places they might want to fish. So
yeah.
Anyway, thanks, and make it a great night and make it a great day tomorrow.
Awesome. Roger, thanks so much.
No problem. Hopefully you all have found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line of our menu. And in the archive, you will see all of our past shows, over 400 shows. Search by any keyword and you'll find, I'm sure you'll find something that will interest you. Our next broadcast will be on October 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Steve Ramirez, and our show is called Casting Homeward. Join us for an engaging episode with Steve, author of Casting Homeward, and dive into America's legendary landscapes, from New England's songbird-filled woods to Yellowstone's wild valleys and Bristol Bay's bear-populated rivers. Steve explores the magic of iconic places and restores our souls and inspire awe. Tune in for a philosophical journey through the wild heart of America and discover stories that connect us to nature's timeless beauty. Be sure to add this our upcoming show to your calendar. Underneath Steve's picture, there's an add to calendar button. Click on that, and you'll be able to add that directly to your calendar so you don't miss the live show. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.